We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
This is Keeping the Faith, a weekly discussion about issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
Welcome to Keeping the Faith. I'm Don Nolan. I'm filling in for Steve this afternoon. Steve is recuperating from a medical procedure, and we hope he'll be back next Sunday. The theme for our program this afternoon is the Champaign Unit for Consent Decree going forward. We have as our guest Mr. Nate Banks, who is the ex-director of the African American Cultural Center, if I got that right?
Yes, that's correct.
For many years. He's been involved in the charter school movement. Nate has been on the Champaign Unit for School Board during the some of the more interesting times during the evolution of the consent decree in Champaign Unit for Schools. And we thank you very much for being with us, Nate.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for coming. We originally scheduled Imani Bazell, but Imani had the great privilege of being invited to South Africa to go train in their elections there. So, Nate, thank you very much for filling in at the at this late date. Mm-hmm. I appreciate it. Well, the consent decree is a long-standing, long-term process. It's been around for 9 years, is that right?
It started in 1996, actually. So even, yeah, about 13.
The formation of it did. When wasn't it signed in 2001, 2002?
2002.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Okay. So the process is a lot older than 9 years. Why don't you tell us a little bit about what a consent decree is for public schools?
Okay. Well, first of all, a consent decree is a judicial decree expressing a voluntary agreement between parties. In this case, the parties were the plaintiff class and the school district, especially in an agreement by a defendant to cease activities that are alleged by the government to be either illegal in, or illegal in return for an end to the charges that the plaintiff class has submitted. So basically, that's what a consent decree is, and it's obviously a legally binding court order that is entered into voluntarily from the perspective of both parties. And so, when it comes to a consent decree with the Champaign School District, the district did enter into an agreement between the plaintiff class and the district to address issues of equity.
And when you say the government, you mean?
Well, in this case, the governmental entity would be the school district. But it's the consent decree itself is actually a federally mandated decree. So it was adjudicated in federal court.
Right. Well, if you would like to call in to talk to Mr. Nate Banks about this, our show is a call-in show, and we can be reached by two numbers locally. You can call in at 333-9455. You can also use an 800 number, 1-800-222-9455. Why did the original plaintiffs consider it to be necessary to have a consent decree with Champaign Unit for Schools? What was the nature of the complaint?
Well, since we have a little bit of time, I did want to read actually from a document
Sure.
that was filed on January the 29th in 2002. It's basically the second revised consent decree document. And so it starts out by saying, in May and July of 1996, the U.S. Department of Education Office of Civil Rights accepted complaints by several families that addressed mandatory one-way busing of African-American students and the educational services provided to those students by Champaign Community Unit District 4. In September of that year, OCR initiated a proactive compliance review of Unit 4 in the areas of overrepresentation of minorities in special education and underrepresentation of minorities in upper-level courses. And then in October of that same year, the OCR complainants, by their counsel, at that point, Futterman and Howard, amended their complaints to include additional allegations of system-wide discrimination in student assignment within school segregation practices and tracking, discipline, and staffing. And then right after that, OCR incorporated the allegations of the complainants into a proactive review. I'm not going to go through the whole document, but basically what happened was there was an audit done of, based on those allegations, there was an audit done by Robert Peterkin. And from that audit, there were several areas where the audit found that the district was not in compliance with law and that there needed to be some sort of remedy. So it was actually, that was the foundation legally for what we're calling the consent decree. Now, from the standpoint of a person in the community, what I saw, having grown up in the Champaign school system, is that there was this huge gap between where the school district was in terms of white students and where the school district was in terms of the needs of African-American students. Having come up in the system myself, I already knew experientially that there were basically two school systems, one for the black children and one for the white children. Although we were all located in the same physical buildings, the district was, in essence, two districts. And so the district that was dealing with African-American students, black students, left a lot to be desired. Students weren't learning. They weren't being respected by their teachers. The list go, they were overrepresented in special education and underrepresented in gifted and talented, all those things that the plaintiff class brought out.
Discipline disparities.
Oh, absolutely, discipline disparities. And so, from that perspective, I think that it was very important that some sort of resolution to those issues come to fruition.
Right. We have an early caller here. Hello, line one, you're on Keeping the Faith. Question or comment?
Good evening. Kind of a question and then maybe a follow-up. Someone who is familiar with the history of the consent decree and feels that the how to put this politely, the school board was dragged kicking and screaming and objecting the whole way, and I felt it was a just decision. Certainly there was enough disparity in the construction of buildings, materials, and the level of the staff who were in the identified North End schools. However, what I'd like to talk about and hear your guest comment on is when it comes to the disciplinary divergence or the difference in rates of discipline.
Disparity, discipline disparities.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I just spaced out on the word. If I'm not saying that this is a given, but if discipline is based upon behavior, would that have been blind to the race of the student or not? Because that seems to me to be a crucial point when you say, well, we have X number of students in the student body and they're receiving, say, twice the amount of discipline of another group of students. If it is based upon behavior, would that not be colorblind?
Thank you. That's a really good question. The answer from my perspective is absolutely not. I respond in that way because there's so much behind the whole notion of behavior when it comes to discipline. See, the school district that I grew up in systemically marginalized black students. And when you're young, you don't have a way to fight back when it comes to people who disrespect you on a daily basis. And that's the kind of environment that I grew up in educationally. And so what students end up doing is they start making up their own rules and their own mores as far as what behavior means. And part of that is to lash back, if you will, at the people who are mistreating them, but hiding behind the fact that there need to be these behavioral expectations. And what I'm not saying is that there should not be a standard of behavior for all students. But if you've grown up in a system that is neglecting you, you're going to act out. And that's one part of it. The other part of it is from the standpoint of those who are administering the discipline, the expectations of the classroom teacher as well as administrators plays a big role in how discipline is carried out. It's not as cut and dried as people would like to think. There's a lot of flexibility in how you interpret what a student does. Now, you know, if a student is just completely dominating the class by bad behavior, or if you will, bad behavior, yeah, you have to do something about that. But the other part of it is, at some point, that student needs to be engaged, and the teacher needs to figure out why is this happening. Now, if we're only talking about one or two students, that's one thing. But when you're talking about a issue that's district-wide, then you have a systemic problem. And so if all things were equal, yes, I'd said behavior should be and the expectations of whatever the rules and regulations of the classroom are should be the determining factor. But there are so many other things that lead into what we would call negative behavior. And unless you're willing as a district to deal with that, that's going to be problematic. And that's what the plaintiff class was trying to get at. It's not that we don't want to have our students held to a high standard, but we also know that there are things that produce that type of behavior, and so those unwarranted disparities are what the consent decree was trying to get at.
Does the caller have a follow-up?
Well, I do. First of all, a comment. Schools cannot address all the system inequities, and in fact, as someone who is intimately involved with Champaign school districts, I would say that staff do not treat African-American students differentially. If a child is not given the opportunity to attend a preschool and feels that shoving is the way to resolve conflict, that is a problem in kindergarten. When you have 25 students, or hopefully 15, you cannot deal with three students whose consistent behavior is to shove. And that is not a school district system problem. That is perhaps a system responsibility outside of the school. And I think that is what was unaddressed by the consent decree, was the system issues that were not involved in the actual school district. The school district has to cope with the students as they are, and I think they do a very good job. But they cannot change the fact that there is no help for the slow learner, i.e. the person who has an IQ above 72 and below 90. And that is a systems issue that the school cannot address. So that would be my comment. And then my question, and I'll listen off the air, is do you feel that it did change as a result of the consent decree? So thank you.
Before you leave, do I feel the what changed? I'm sorry.
Oh, I think we lost the call. Okay. Thank you for your call.
Well, again, this is one of the things that when I was on the board, the position of the administration was, no, we can't control what happens to the students outside of the school district or outside of the school day, but we can make sure that the policies and practices that we are initiating will address the students while they're there. If you have a class of kindergartners and three or four of them haven't been given the proper training to be ready to sit in that kindergarten seat, you still got to do something with them. And so there are a couple of things that you can do. You can either you can either punish them from kindergarten up through the time that they leave, or you can figure out ways while they're with you to give them other ways of dealing with the issues that they bring to you. And the district does have a responsibility to do those kinds of things. The district is not anywhere near in the business of working miracles, certainly. But when those students are in those chairs, it's up to the district to determine how best to handle those students. And there's such a thing as writing off a student. And if you are doing that system-wide, then that needs to change. And that was one of the reasons why the consent decree, again, was entered into, because there were so many students that were being disproportionately disciplined and more harshly disciplined, as a matter of fact. One of the things I didn't hadn't brought it out yet, but one of the components of coming up with the consent decree was the whole notion of doing a climate study. And one of the issues that was raised by the climate study by white children and black children was that there was a different way of disciplining black children than there was white children, even for the exact same offense. So even the students themselves knew that that was a problem. It seems that to me that it's only the adults that won't own up to that, and so that's why the district had to be taken to court, so that those things could be addressed in a way that the students could benefit from.
So schools can't do everything, but they can do some things. And the consent decree was addressing those some things that the district could do but wasn't.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
Just to remind our listeners, this is a call-in show. We are talking with Nate Banks, who used to be on the Champaign Unit 4 School Board. You were just off last May, is that right?
Yes, that's right.
Nate served during some very interesting times, during which the Champaign Unit 4 consent decree was being operationalized, and we are talking about that legal decision and going to discuss later in the program how we see things are going to evolve in the future. And if you'd like to call and talk about this problem with Mr. Banks, you can call in at 333-9455. There's also an 800 number, 1-800-222-9455. I've often heard it, this refrain, that kids come to schools from the so-called real world into the schools as if schools weren't a part of the real world. They're very much a part of the real world, and they contribute to the real world in their own ways. And as I understand, the plaintiffs, they were trying not to get schools to solve all the problems of society, but try to get to do what, with the resources available, were necessary to help some of these kids who were, as you describe, acting out. Do you have any idea in one of these various areas, discipline, special ed, or gifted, what the disparities were back then? There were,
for instance, if you take gifted and talented, the percentage of African-American students that were in gifted and talented classes were like in the single digits. Mm-hmm. And now it's much more representative of that population in the district itself.
And the African-American population is still around 15%?
No.
12?
The total population?
Right.
No, it's about 35%.
Of the students?
Yes.
Uh-huh. In the town, Champaign, it's...
Oh, I'm sorry, yes.
15, is that right?
Yeah, I think African-Americans are about 15% of the population.
Right. So you have 30% African-American children and single digits in gifted programs and huge numbers in special ed programs.
Right, and a lot of those numbers and percentages have changed over the course of time that the consent decree has been in, that the consent decree was enforce. So that's one. Both of those areas actually are areas that I think that there has been significant improvement, probably a little more so in the gifted and talented, and, which gets back to the other point that was being made when it comes to discipline. Gifted and talented at one point in time was completely teacher discretion. So it depended on who the teachers recommended as to who got into gifted and talented. So one of the things, and maybe we'll get into this a little bit, that testing does do is if you have an entry test or if you have an entry assessment that all children have to go through, you're going to find those students that are gifted then. Whatever we decide to use as the measurement for gifted, you'll find there are African-American students that, fill that bill. And so that's what's been happening with gifted and talented. And I would have to say that during the course of my tenure on the board, when it comes to special education, there has been a real effort on the part of the district to make that process as fair as possible. As a matter of fact, one of the comments that Judge Billy Joe McDade made was, in most districts, parents are trying the best they can to get their children into special education because they've got these extra services that they can get. And in our district, the district's trying to keep students out of it. And so, you know, you've always got this dynamic that's going on. You want to make sure that there are not unwarranted disparities, but you certainly don't want students who need services not to get those services just to make the numbers look good.
We have a caller on line one. Welcome to Keeping the Faith. Your question or comment?
Hello?
Hello.
Yes, hi. This is Marcia Terry. I'm calling in to ask a question.
Thanks for your call.
Glad to make it. I'd like to ask a question about Unit 4. Assuming that Unit 4 will have to make budget cuts, what do you think might be those cuts might be, and how will they affect the implementation of the consent decree?
Thank you very much. Well, you've kind of been out of the loop since May, so
and I'm so glad I have.
Those are hard things
I don't
to do.
I don't want to dodge that question, but I certainly don't have an answer as to how the district is going to address those very real budgetary issues. But I do know that from what the past focus has been, equity issues are not going. Shouldn't suffer greatly because the district basically has a document that says that the district is going to continue to address equity issues through that EEE committee that has been established. So now when it comes down to the everyday operation of classrooms, my understanding is the district is trying to keep the educational program as intact as it possibly can, and then some of the other cuts that are going to have to be made will be made outside of the educational program to the greatest extent possible.
Usually class size becomes an issue?
It might. Yeah, class size might become an issue. But I don't see any wholesale retreat. But again, I'm now, as just a regular citizen, I am not privy to some of those discussions that are going on. It would seem to me out of character for the district to do that, though.
Now, the consent decree has been terminated, right?
Yes, yes.
And that happened when?
That happened in just a few months ago. Let me get the exact date. July of 2009.
Yeah. And Judge Billy Joe McDade, is that right, agreed that the district had made sufficient progress to justify the termination, and the follow-up with that was to form a committee that you are now on.
Right.
What is that committee?
It's called the Educational Equity Excellence Committee.
And what is that committee going to be doing?
Well, the committee is
or has done.
Actually, the committee is just now beginning to meet. We've had one meeting. But let me, and I'll talk about that too, but the settlement that the judge agreed to was actually a settlement between the district and the plaintiff class. The consent decree was supposed to have ended about 6 months prior to that. and the plaintiff class had asked for an extension to deal with several areas that it felt were not still being adequate or still needed adequate monitoring. So the district and the plaintiff class came up with a settlement agreement, and they agreed on the following things: that the board would adopt and implement a policy regarding the opening and closing of schools. The policy will state that in making decisions regarding the opening and closing of schools, the board shall consider reasonable alternatives and a range of factors, including the impact of African American and all other students, and the transportation burdens on African American and all other students. That was to address the control choice piece. For any pending or future openings and closing of schools, the board shall have a publicly reported third party analysis that complies with board policy regarding the opening and closing of schools. The board will pass a resolution of reaffirming its commitment to add a total of two strands of new seating capacity at Booker T. Washington and Garden Hills, and the board shall adopt and implement an equity policy establishing an Education Equity Excellence Committee, which is what we were just talking about. That committee would be comprised of district staff, a diverse cross-section of the community, and facilitated by a third party familiar with the community and the district issues for at least 1 year. And the purpose of that committee is to review and discuss the following equity areas, including data disaggregated by race and ethnicity and social economic status, academic progress of regular education, special education, and gifted and honors programs, as well as the academic academy and alternative students. It's to monitor attendance rates, discipline rates, and graduation rates. So that committee is going to establish task forces on the equity areas as deemed necessary based on those areas that I just mentioned. And the superintendent is to provide a public report each semester on those equity issues and report that also to that committee.
Is there a legal framework for those who were sympathetic with the plaintiffs to bring the district into compliance if they are not satisfied with the monitoring and the progress on these areas?
Probably what would have to be done is another lawsuit would have to be filed, because at this point that consent decree is retired.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So as far as the judge is concerned, that case has been
mm-hmm.
settled.
Mm-hmm. So it would require another filing.
Yes.
I see. Are you confident about this committee? How do you feel about it? You're on it.
It depends on where things will go within the next few months and in the next few meetings. And the reason it's not that I'm hesitant, it's I guess my expectations are not very high because I understand the committee structure. Basically what the committee is being asked to do is just to monitor if the district is following through mm-hmm. on what it said it was going to do. And that should be pretty easy to do. So I'm not looking at anything major coming out of that committee. But it is...
Do you report to the board or to the superintendent?
That's a good question. All the committees report to the board. So it's the superintendent that will report to this committee. And then if the board needs further information, then representatives of the committee would report to the board. But the superintendent in his updates to the board would give the same information that he gives the committee. So I think the committee's job basically is to ask the right questions based on the charge that the committee has.
Mm-hmm.
So in that sense, yes, I think the committee will probably be able to fulfill its function. As I look at the people who are around the table, everyone is engaged, everyone is interested in continuing the work. And as the administration has said, that's the administration would like for this committee to help them to continue to move the process forward in each one of those areas that were mentioned.
Now, there are various areas that the committee is going to be looking at. One of them is attendance. And over the past decade, at least two new schools have been built. And I understand something new is happening at Washington. Isn't that right?
Right.
What's going on?
Booker T. Washington is going to be raised and rebuilt as a three-strand school. So the school district is in the process right now of doing that. And
is it going to become a magnet?
It's supposed to be a magnet as well. And the magnet for that school is going to be STEM. Mm-hmm. It'll be a STEM school. And for those of you who don't, I'm sorry, I've fallen into this jargon that I rail against so often. But or the acronyms, STEM is Science, Technology, Engineering, and Math. So that's sort of the latest trend in educational circles to get students engaged in the 21st century world. So, Booker T. Washington is going to be a STEM school, and I think there are a lot of good possibilities for that school.
Now, there was a lot of talk back earlier about building a new school in the north in order to alleviate the burden of busing African-American kids south. Is this Washington school three-strand plan going to alleviate that problem?
Well, actually, the combination of the Booker T. Washington and the Garden Hills, adding a strand there, is specifically to address that consent decree issue.
Mm-hmm. Why is that an issue? What is the burden for people who don't understand the problem for African-American kids in moving from one school to another? What is the issue here? Why was this a complaint on the consent decree to begin with?
Well, basically, actually it's begun to happen already with that recent Supreme Court ruling. If race is no longer an issue and the school district just allow students to come to each one of the attendance centers by where they live, there aren't enough
neighborhood schools.
Or neighborhood schools. There aren't enough seats in the north part of town to accommodate all the children that live there. So the whole purpose of the adding of those 200 seats was to address that structural issue, but also certainly the programmatic issue that would be involved with what it. Because it's one thing to put the seats there, something else to have the school attractive enough so that students will want to come to that school. And so that was the thinking.
Now, once Garden Hills and Washington schools are up and running with these extra seats, you're going to have more and more neighborhood racially identified schools in those locations, right?
If truth be told, they're already that way.
Right.
So,
integration.
That's where the magnet piece comes in, because the whole idea of a magnet school is to have a program that attracts families that are interested in the program. So, the hope and the intent is that there will be many more students from different parts of the community wanting to attend those schools.
So the idea is, if you have a STEM school at Washington, which is in what we in locally called the North End, is such an exciting program, white students from the South will want to compete for those seats.
Yeah, yeah. Or at least I wouldn't use the word compete, but they would want a seat at that school, yes.
Will there still be guidelines for distributing how many kids get those seats in racial terms, or is that's now against the law?
That is now against the law, according to our Supreme Court, our recent Supreme Court.
Robert Supreme Court.
Yes, that one. But what we ran some numbers over a year ago regarding social economic status, and what the district found was that actually the school attendance centers will probably remain about the same if we use SES, or social economic status, rather than race.
Which is
permitted. Mm-hmm. I think that's probably – I don't think the tenor of the schools is going to change much at all.
for a long period of time, many people, in fact, back in the day when the consent decree was in front of the school board, were arguing for socioeconomic criteria rather than racial criteria from the get-go.
Mm-hmm.
I take it, given your earlier comments, that you feel that it's unfortunate that racial issues aren't also addressed, but at least we have socioeconomic criteria that can get close to those issues.
Yes, I would agree with that. See, the unfortunate thing of this whole ordeal, if you will, because I don't think everybody in the community understands, this has been an ordeal. This is not something that the black community wanted to do. This is something that we had to do.
Well, it's been an ordeal for 200 years.
Well, yeah,
in this community.
Yeah. Now that the larger community is feeling some of that pain, we empathize with that because that's what we've been going through all these years. That's why the suit was filed. But having said that, the better way of handling that is when the district sees itself as being a district for all the children in the district and wanting to make sure that all the children in the district succeed. And I think we're getting closer to the point where the classroom teacher, the principals, the support staff are beginning as a district to get that picture. And I think that's an encouragement.
Yeah, I wanted to address that specific issue, but let me just remind our audience, this is a call-in show. We're talking to Mr. Nate Banks, who was on the Champaign Unit 4 School Board during a key period during the consent decree that has recently come to an end. Nate went off the board in May, and he is here to talk with us about the consent decree going forward for Champaign Unit 4 schools. And if you'd like to call in and talk about this issue, our local number is 333-9455. You can call 1-800-222-9455 if you'd like to talk with Nate Banks about the Champaign Unit 4 consent decree. Now, you were talking about you felt that things were coming together in significant ways. I gather from your comments, looking back, that you feel that the consent decree was necessary. On balance, do you think that the outcomes now have been more positive than negative?
Yes, and I'll give that as a qualified yes. But empirically, let me start with that first. I want to give you the listening audience some information.
Sure.
Vernon Barksdale School, which is an elementary school, this past school year.
You might want to just commemorate Vern's history, by the way.
Yeah, Vernon Barksdale was the director of the Champaign County Urban League for many years, and the work that he did in terms of education, in terms of community development, was just unparalleled, and so the district, in its wisdom, chose to honor Vernon Barksdale by naming Barksdale after him.
Sorry about that. Go ahead.
At Barksdale School, in the 2009 Illinois School Report Card, at that school, 89% of all of the students are reading at or exceeding they're meeting the standards, mm-hmm, from the Illinois standards. And 98% of those students are meeting the Illinois standards when it comes to mathematics. Now, if you break that down into race, 94% of the students at Barksdale that are white are meeting or exceeding those standards, and 99% of the white students are meeting or exceeding the standards in mathematics. And if you look at the African-American children, 76%, 7 out of 10 children that go to that school are meeting or exceeding the standards in reading, and 93% are meeting or exceeding the standards in mathematics.
Last year,
mm-hmm, past year. Now, that's Barksdale, and at Barksdale, there are, in terms of the percentage of African-American students, it's about 26%. And the percentage of low-income students at Barksdale is 24%. But I want to also focus on Cary Busey. And the reason I'm mentioning these two schools is to address the point, have things been working? Because when I first came onto the school board, none of the African-American children were anywhere near those numbers, right, when it comes to achievement levels. So at Cary Busey School, the African-American students in reading are reading at a 77% level. So that means almost 8 out of 10 children at Cary Busey are reading and meeting the state standards. And 80% of the white students are. So there's just a very small gap there. That gap has definitely decreased. In mathematics, 77% of the students, the African-American students, are meeting state standards compared to 93% of the white students. Now, the interesting thing, though, when you look at the socioeconomic status, first of all, African-American students at that school comprise almost 50% of the school, and the low income Cary Busey. And the low income numbers, 61% of those students are low income students, mm-hmm, which means that it's not just the students who do well because their parents have enough financial wherewithal, which there's nothing wrong with that, but at a school with a large percentage of low-income students, Cary Busey students are doing very well.
Something's working.
Something is working. Yeah. And so the things that are working have been in response to the consent decree.
Right. We have a caller who's been waiting patiently on line one. Hello, you're on Keeping the Faith. You have a question or comment?
Kind of something a little bit of both. I am actually a student that I've been working towards my elementary education certification, and I've had an opportunity pretty much since 2006 to spend time in various schools around town, Cary Busey, Westview, also over at Booker T. Washington and other schools, and this is kind of that prime area of when the consent decree was going on, and most of my education and training towards becoming a new teacher has been in this new environment.
What years, just to be clear, were you in the schools? What years?
I was at Booker T. Washington during 2006. I was at Cary Busey during 2007.
Okay.
And also Westview this last year. But I've also had chances to see practicums that have been outside of the area because I'm doing my certification process through Eastern Illinois University.
Thank you.
Now, the question that I have is actually more on the line of advice, because I've had a chance to have countless informal conversations with teachers with the whole spectrum of opinions and ideas about the consent decree. What I'm very much curious about is the perspective of a board member, perhaps even advice for a teacher heading into the teaching profession with the consent decree now finally completed. And I'll hang up and listen. Thank you very much.
Well, the advice that I would give you as a former board member is the same advice that I would give you as a citizen in the community. First of all, I want to commend you for going into the field of education, because you are needed, and our children hopefully will greatly benefit by the things that you do and the things that you bring to the class. One thing that the consent decree has enabled in the classroom, believe it or not, is teachers who really care about students are able to do what they need to do so that the students can get what they need from the teachers, and that there is a high expectation from administration that the teachers will provide those kinds of activities. So having said that, my experience is that what students really thrive on, especially African-American students, is relationships. Teachers who are able to build strong relationships with students are going to find success in their classroom. You're not going to get everybody, but students can tell if you like them or if you don't like them or if you're indifferent to them. And that's part of the untold story about how do you educate African-American children. Mm-hmm. As long as they know you care, you can be hard on them. You can have high standards if they think you care about them as a person. And so I guess my advice to any teacher, first of all, know your subject, have a good handle on how you want to present that subject to your students, be willing to listen to the students, and be observant as to how they're receiving what you're giving them. But ultimately, they need to know that you like them and that you like what you're doing. So I'm hoping that more teachers in the district that are like that become the majority. And when that happens, see, and I guess that's the other piece that I would mention, everything revolves around these tipping points. You know, if you've got enough teachers who are operating that way, you're going to see exponential positive
other teachers
happening.
Picking up on the
yeah,
spirit.
Right. Mm-hmm. So I guess that, but, you know, I say that all the time. So it's not just as a board member.
So when you hear someone say, a teacher or someone reporting what they've heard another teacher say, things like, well, we have to not discipline black kids, otherwise we'll get in trouble. Do you infer that maybe that teacher or that classroom hasn't established those relationships with the black kids, or that the black kids themselves pick up on this and realize that they're not really welcome here? And I mean, that's what I hear when I hear someone say, well, we'll get in trouble if we discipline this African-American kid, or if you send them down to the office, they'll just let them sit there but not do anything. Those cynical kinds of responses says to me anyway that something in the leadership of that school and the spirit of that school hasn't caught fire yet. They haven't gotten it.
Well, let me tell you my take on one way of interpreting a comment like that. There was a time when if a child was being disruptive, you just write them up and send them to the office, okay? And those discipline referral slips add up, okay? If that's your approach to discipline, get out of my classroom because you're disrupting the classroom. The other way of approaching discipline is having the classroom teacher themselves deal with the discipline issue as much as they can while the student is in the classroom. Some teachers have interpreted that as you don't want us to discipline, because in their mind, discipline means get out of my class. That's part of the problem. It's a perception of what the job of the teacher actually is. Again, if you've got an extremely disruptive student, you have to do something about that. But there are so many gradations, there are so many gray areas that can actually be taken care of with good classroom management, where you won't get to that point. And see, that's what the administration has been trying to equip the district staff with, the tools to be able to manage their classrooms in a manner where they don't have to refer so many people. Students to the office or to the detention room or whatever the room is called. Mm-hmm. So it has more, I think it has more to do with that than the district saying, we don't want you to discipline the students. And it's really unfortunate that staff would, some staff, I think, again, we're getting to the point where staff realizes that wasn't the message. That I know when you were on the board, that wasn't the message that you were sending, and it certainly wasn't the message that I was trying to send.
Right, but there's the formal message and then the informal message that you get in the coffee room and in the hall when teachers talk to each other, administrators talk to each other. So the comment earlier about the child in kindergarten that shoves back, isn't it the case that there are schools that encounter these kinds of behaviors that have dealt with those problems and become positive learning environments and high-achieving learning environments and address those issues? So simply to say, well, it's society, blame society, we can't deal with it, the school can deal with it if they use some moral imagination, right?
Oh, absolutely. And there are actually a couple of schools here locally, I won't name them, but that deal with troubled children, and they have protocols for handling those kinds of situations. I think when we think about a 21st century school, one of the things that I always say is that in our school district, we had an 18th century attitude about race. We have a 20th century model for schools, and we're trying to teach 21st century children. Mm. And so we've got to bring ourselves up to speed as to how you deal with the children that are in front of you today. This is not 1950. Mm-hmm. You've got children coming into these classrooms with serious issues, and we don't want to minimize that. As a matter of fact, what the school district needs to be doing is figuring out ways of doing what it needs to do and mitigating those issues that the students are bringing. So just to say, well, the society made them that way, so there's nothing we can do about it, we don't have that option anymore.
Right. We just have a few more minutes left. Just to refresh the listeners' memory, we're talking to Mr. Nate Banks, who just retired from the Champaign Unit for School Board and spent about 6 years during the most critical times of the Champaign Unit for Consent Decree, dealing with educational equity and excellence issues for African American and other children besides not just African Americans but across the board, dealing with disparities in the school district in various different areas. And the consent decree has been terminated, and we're talking today about the consent decree going forward. If you'd like to call in to talk about this issue, we have just a few minutes left. You can call 333-9455. You can also call an 800 number, 1-800-222-9455. Well, looking back on all of this from your perspective, what is there about this process that you've been through in dealing with the consent decree that you would change if you could go back and wave your wand or rewind the tape, do a time machine? How would you improve this process?
I think what I'm not even sure if it could have been, but what I would have preferred to have seen with the consent decree is that it would have been more elastic. Because in so many cases, we spent so much time dealing with issues that were 4, 5, and 6 years old, and actually the real-time issues had morphed into something different. Mm. But because we were still having to legally deal with those other issues, it sometimes made it very frustrating, which is why I have to confess that I wanted to see the consent decree end, not because I don't think that the issues have gone away, but because of all of the time that we have to spend in that minutia that really didn't move the agenda forward. So mm-hmm. I don't even know if it's possible to have a consent decree that's elastic enough to take into consideration changes that might happen, but certainly that would be one of the areas that I would have changed. The other area that I would have changed from the plaintiff class is the notion that there are other ways of dealing with equity that could perhaps have been used to engage the school system besides the ones that were used.
Which you mean is not the legal challenge?
The legal challenge, I think, needed to happen because that's the only way that black folk can get any kind of attention from the system. But what I'm saying is, and I'll be very specific.
Has been since 1954, right?
Absolutely, and is continuing today. But the what could have happened is that this whole notion, for instance, of charter schools was never able to be put on the table in any meaningful way, when in actuality that could have been one of the ways that uh, that the district could have worked with the community to address that need.
You were in the leadership of trying to get a charter school going some years ago,
right,
if I remember.
Right. And so, but the reason why I wanted to pursue that was because the problems that first caller mentioned, those societal issues and problems, do need to be addressed in conjunction with a school environment, because the students spend so much of their time in the school environment. But it's going to take other resources and other entities outside of what we normally consider the public school environment to address those issues. And the public schools just have too much on their plates to be able to deal with all those other issues. So this collaboration, that's the one area. You didn't ask me yet what I thought the negative was. The negative is the district has so many other issues that are always presenting itself to them. And I'm sure as a former board member, you realize it's always the tyranny of the immediate.
Right.
There's very little time for creative thinking to go on. And so a charter school could have actually produced an environment where that kind of thing could happen. And the community groups and the community agencies that do know how to deal with those children that'll kick their those 5-year-olds that'll kick their kindergarten teacher, there are agencies and people who know how to work with those children. So working in conjunction with the classroom would produce, I think, a very positive model for the district to then emulate. Mm-hmm. So that's one area that I think, from the plaintiff's position, could have and should have been taken a little bit more seriously.
Well, charter schools aren't really alternative ed, but I suppose you could say they're in that class or category. How has alternative ed gone in Unit 4? I mean, I remember back when I was on the board, one of the great concerns with making Columbia School an alternative educational center was it would become a dumping ground for all of these kids that we're talking about. Mm-hmm. And I fear possibly to some extent it was. Has that issue been addressed with the alternative?
It's still being addressed, but I will tell you this. The academic academy that has been established, and it is an alternative program, is outstanding. And
good.
And they're actually doing...
Describe that. Where is that located?
It's located actually right across the street from Stratton Elementary in the old public health building, I think. And the problem with it is, though, it serves about 60 students, and there are significantly more students that would probably be able to benefit from a program like that. And not only that, but it's an alternative school on the high school level. And we really need to start looking at how we can provide some alternatives for upper elementary and middle school, yeah.
And elementary, too.
Yeah, yeah.
Because these problems start early.
Yeah, because if you can get them early, then I think the students will be much more successful.
All right. Well, we've been talking with Mr. Nate Banks, who was on the Champaign Unit 4 School Board during the days of the consent decree, and we've been discussing the consent decree going forward. Nate, thank you so much for showing up at this program and agreeing to be with us today.
My pleasure.
I appreciate it. Thank you very much. Steve Shoemaker, we'll be back next week on Keeping the Faith. Thank you.
You've been listening to Keepin' the Faith, the production of WILL AM 580. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants.